When it comes to this, again, to this worldview of the Bible, and as we navigate at the beginning, the brand new beginning of a school year, again, with the hopes that this is not 2020.2. We're hoping that this is a brand new year. We're hoping that we can finish the semester, you know, beginning right now in August, and just get to December. And hopefully students, they don't have to, you know, get back home earlier, or again, go into hybrid or online, exclusively online. Because I know students, especially college, I'm looking at my kids and their universities. I mean, they're enjoying themselves. They're enjoying with the newness of the semester. Even as I speak to you tonight, my son is actually at a freshman orientation. He's not a freshman, but he's actually promoting his church, Eris Church in Dallas. And again, it's just this excitement, you know, of a lot of things happening. And here's the thing that I will say to you. As we see kindergartens going to school, first graders, you know, middle school students, whether you are doing the homeschool for the first time, you know, blessings to you as a mom, as a dad, doing the homeschool, whatever you may find yourself on this, what the new school year is doing and will do is going to definitely expose the worldview, the mindset, the understanding of who we are. And by that, unavoidably, for those who follow Christ, we are being exposed to actually, again, express or experience the worldview of the Bible. And whether we are going to actually make decisions through the lenses of the scriptures, or potentially or tragically, we're going to start making decisions against or completely isolated from the scriptures. One of the things that I've been saying lately when it comes to what's taking place even around the world, and specifically in places like Afghanistan, and I touched on this last week, is that, you know, just coming back into the worldview of the scriptures, is precisely that when it comes to something like Islam, and specifically when you look at what's taking place in Afghanistan, and this entire revolution, tragically, you know, seeing just the devastation of government systems and things like that, at the bottom of the conversation, this movement, this radical Islamic movement, is definitely a theological kind of a, you know, background, or some sort of a engine that is moving this forward. And the challenge with having, you know, these world religions, and specifically this one in particular, that is so aggressive and so, I mean, so evangelistic in their mindset, the tragedy is that most of Western civilization, most of the Western hemisphere, including the beautiful United States of America, we have fallen into so much secularism. And when I use the word secular, I'm speaking of a generation of men and women. I'm speaking of, again, students, school teachers, politicians. I'm speaking of just people around, you know, whether you look at Europe, you look at Canada, you look at the United States, and even Central and South America, where we tragically don't have that religious or biblical reference to make decisions. So the conversation between, again, the Islamic, you know, movement that you see in Afghanistan and around the world, which is driven, and definitely driving force, is a theological view. I'm not saying that is the right theological view. All that I'm saying is that it is a theological view. It is since so much, different from a lot of our governmental systems. And again, I'm speaking from our governmental system that tragically is not characterized by a Christian worldview. All that to say that when, again, you look at politics, you look at the world, what's going on, you look at a new school year, you look at homes and families, you look at the things that we're doing, how churches are responding to, again, this whole, transition that we're facing. At the end of the day, and again, we're coming from last week, and we introduced this concept last week, or reintroduce it, but you look at the state, you look at the government, that tragically, when the biblical worldview is literally removed, what you get, instead of an entity that is going to exercise the authority given by the Lord, by God, now you're going to see a generation of, again, world leaders that we are approving autonomy. So ultimately, the separation, I don't think, is between the state and the church, but it's literally the state and God. At the same time, coming back to the church, coming back to the people of God, because as you know, when it comes to the scriptures, when it comes to prophets, when it comes to apostles speaking to the people of God, they begin with the people of God before they can speak into the nations. And tragically for us, we are now different in that regard. So we begin with the church, and the church, just as the government, we said last week, as the government has moved conveniently or naively, whatever you might want to call it, by disregarding the scriptures, by disregarding the biblical worldview, our governments have moved from, again, authority into autonomy. As churches, we have done exactly the same. And now we have moved from doctrine, from understanding the Christian, the biblical worldview, into basically what the biblical worldview is supposed to create, is supposed to produce. So what we have done is that we have literally made the means, we made it the end, and vice versa. So all that I'm saying is that we both, as entities, we are just completely confused. And that's when I think about this new school year, how do we, as parents, how do we, as grandparents and even as students, how do we process this brand new school year, that when the students see what's taking place around the world, when we again try to reconnect our family to church, whether it's in person or virtual, however we're trying to do this and move forward, how do we take this season of life and reestablish the biblical principle of what the church is supposed to do and be? And also the same thing for the government and for life as a whole. So hopefully that we can do as a generation, hopefully that we face this brand new school year with the excitement and the newness and the opportunity, and then with the trust that the Lord is going to lead us into this time. But the win at the end is simply that if you can come back and look at the senior class, whether it's, high school students going into college or college students graduating from college, whatever you may see this transition as you come into May, the month of May 2022, and graduation comes at the end, and you see elementary students moving into junior high and junior high into high school and so forth. Can you imagine if we had a generation of young men, young adults, church leaders, politicians, world leaders, that we can come back and utilize this time once again to come back to the biblical understanding of what the government is supposed to be and do, and what the church is supposed to be and do. See, 2,000 years ago, we said last week that Jesus is facing exactly the same dilemma. 2,000 years ago, Jesus has spent basically 3 years with a generation of men and women that they were confused. Tragically, they were confused. And the confusion primarily was basically based on those categories that I just gave you. What you got 2,000 years ago, Jesus' experience coming into the world after 3 years of ministry. So I'm speaking of Jesus at the end of his journey, earthly ministry. He's coming into a generation that still is functioning with a lot of autonomy versus exercising the limited authority that government is supposed to have. Through the entire Old Testament, which is the Bible of Jesus and the apostles, through the entire Old Testament, we can see the nations, we can see world powers literally being utilized by God to fulfill his promises, to fulfill his will, especially in the people of God. And I'm saying this because, I don't have the time right now to get into the details, but theologically, I can assure you that evil fulfills the purposes of God. Every single thing fulfills the purposes of God. God is sovereign. And I'm saying this because, again, as much as we are seeing the confusion today, as much as we are paying the price, 2,000 years ago, that was exactly the same scenario in that regard. And the same scenario that, tragically, the people of God were enamored with moralism, with what they were supposed to do. And this is where I keep on bringing back into the conversation that the gospel is not what the people of God do. The gospel is what Jesus did. The gospel is not what the people of God desire to do for the Lord. The gospel is everything that God has done without our help. That's the gospel. So I'm using the word justification just to illustrate doctrine or to illustrate what God has done. I'm thinking of the book of Romans, where Paul invests basically 11 chapters, the first 11 chapters of Romans, where he is going to go very in-depth into doctrine, into theology, into principles that allows us to remind ourselves that this is about God's eternal redemptive plan. And then beginning on chapter 12 in Romans, you're going to start seeing now that this is what it means. This is what you do based on what God has done. So now you get into the morality. You get into the actually exercising, into the actually, going, and the actual transformation. And we may call this sanctification. Tragically, 2,000 years ago, I'm going to say this again, 2,000 years ago, the church was so confused doctrinally, organizationally, leadership-wise, that not only they make this mistake, which we are doing it today again, but tragically that implies that they rejected the character of Jesus. And again, I said it before and I'm going to say it again, and I know this sounds really prejudiced and potentially offends many of us, if not all of us, because obviously this begins with me. But this weekend, again, going back to this weekend, you know, many of the sermons, many of the preaching that was presented literally was based on what people are supposed to do, what the church is supposed to do, what my kids are supposed to do as they go back to school, what, you know, marriage is supposed to do, what governmental officials, everything's about what we're supposed to do. And I am not against, and I believe the Bible gives us plenty of imperatives, plenty of mandates. Again, I'm just using the book of Romans to illustrate that. But from chapter 12 and following, it's nothing else but just imperatives. But I'm going to say that again. Those imperatives, they have to be based, built, founded on what God has done. Because this is the result. See, what we do is the result of what God has done. What we do is not the evidence. You see, evidence is something that potentially you can try to put God on your debt. Because if you begin with this, you can potentially say, because I don't do X, Y, and Z, and because I stopped doing all these things, then God owes me. See, I will argue that's prosperity gospel. It's just the lie that if you keep, you know, these rules and you keep this kind of a code of ethic, then you see, I'm not against the rules. I'm not against the code of ethic. But I'm going to say it again. That is based on the person of Jesus, on the character of Jesus. And 2,000 years ago, Jesus having a conversation with those who tragically fall into that. They fell into that. I'm speaking of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Jesus is utilizing that very difficult, because all those conversations were difficult. Difficult conversations. He's using that to help the disciples understand that ultimately the issue is literally the teaching of this confused generation. So again, just translate that and try to take some of these principles and make them applicable to what is taking place as in today's Tuesday. So for many of you, this is your second day of school. Some of you is your second week, whatever you may find yourself. Again, the teaching, you know, the instruction that we are receiving from church, from school systems, from homes, from governmental systems, is literally based potentially on a teaching that, if we're not careful, is literally based on the autonomy of thinking that this is about me, is about what I want, my personal preferences, or potentially on my indulgence. Literally, because I'm utilizing religion, I'm utilizing my belief system as long as it works for me. Well, all of that is going to be literally put upside down with the person of Jesus, because he's given the warning. And the warning that he's given in regards of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees, which I just kind of illustrated with the state and the church, and the government and the church. We said last week that is the tragedy of thinking that the scriptures, that salvation, that life is about the people of God. And we use the term ecclesiology just because it's kind of a, you know, the doctrinal, the theological view of the study of the church or the people of God. So in this case, what we need to understand is that when we embrace the biblical worldview helps you understand that this is not about us. That this entire book is not about, that the story is not about us. That this is the narrative, this is the character, this is the mind of one specific person. His name is Jesus. Jesus is the fulfillment of the scriptures. And this is why when you begin with us, you begin with you. When I begin with myself on this, then my mission, my understanding, worldview, my personal preference, my experiences, they set the pattern. They set kind of the agenda over these things. And tragically, at the end, what happens is I ended up falling into the lie that basically Jesus is my cosmic butler. Well, once again, history will tell us otherwise, that in reality, what Jesus is warning the disciples in Matthew chapter 16 is to be careful, is warning them from the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees, because it's against the worldview of the Bible. So the question is, what do you do when this is the pattern of a normal, you know, family, a normal Christian church today? What do you do when preaching looks like this most of the time? What do you do when because of, again, the uncertainty and the difficulties and the tragedies of life, by default, I think we all fall into this situation. What do you do about it? Well, what you don't want to do is simply to try to fix it yourself. Once again, remember, see, what you don't want to do is simply fall into the thinking that all that you need to do is to get a better version of yourself, better version of the church, better version of the marriage, better version of the school year. Now, I'm not against of improving things, but basically what Jesus is going to remind the disciples, because this is Matthew chapter 16, so this is where he's moving into that very well-known passage that I'm fixing to read, where Jesus is going to ask them, who is it that people say that I am? And eventually Peter is going to make a confession of who Jesus is. And then he says, upon this confession, upon this rock, I will build my church. And then he gives this amazing promise, amazing statement that is not, I want you to hear this, this statement of Jesus is not based on the ability or the promise that the apostles are going to fix this. This promise that Jesus will build his church and the gates of Hades will not prevail is not based on the promise or the hope that this is going to change. It's simply made in spite of the condition. And I don't know if that's helpful tonight for anybody, because again, I have no clue how the remaining of this year is going to look. Again, I said it a while ago. Our hope and prayer is that the remaining of this year is not going to be 2020.2, meaning the extended version of last year, because it was extremely difficult last year. What we're praying and hoping is that in spite of what's going on today, in spite of how this school year unfolds for our students, for the school system, regardless of how the government deals with the just craziness of what is taking place today, whether, you know, the vaccines work, whatever it may be, if we can get to the place that we might be empowered to believe what Jesus said about himself 2,000 years ago. Now, what that entails, and this is what I'm hoping that at the beginning of the school year, and I'm coming back to school year because, again, this is the week where students went back to school, or some students are struggling whether they need to go back to school or not. Can we just agree tonight, just a very simple kind of a manner on, and I'm inviting you to kind of a, on your own, go to the scriptures and also, I guess, wrestle with some of these principles, that since the antidote of this issue, which is, again, this is the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees, the antidote is not a better version of Pharisees and Sadducees, or the apostles for that matter. The antidote is literally the supremacy of Jesus. It's Jesus first. It's understanding that this is about the person and the character of Jesus. Now, the implication is that the person of Jesus is nothing else but simply what Jesus said and affirmed, the truths that he said about him. Because that's ultimately what's going to be the determining factor. I mean, eventually these Pharisees, Sadducees, religious leaders are going to struggle, not simply with the teachings of Jesus, but specifically with what Jesus says about him. So can you imagine, as students go back to school and they navigate a brand new school year, again, just moving into the newness of this season of life, can you imagine that our kids, our grandkids, had the ability to process, to articulate, to believe, to embrace what Jesus said about himself? The implication of that is that that creates now the worldview of Jesus. So the worldview is simply the result of the affirmation of what Jesus said about him. And I'm saying this because tragically, many of us, if not most of us, when it comes to church, when it comes to the scriptures, when it comes to spirituality, we typically approach the church, God, or the scriptures, trying to find out what Jesus said about us, about my marriage, about my kids, about my illness, about the loss that I just went through. And there is plenty that the Bible or Jesus is going to say about us. But that is not the gospel. See, I'm going to say that again. The gospel is based exclusively on what Jesus said about himself, which ultimately is reflected on how Jesus made process decisions, how he processed life, rejection, opposition, how he related to his heavenly Father. How did he submit to a government that was broken? How did he do that? Well, that's Jesus' worldview. And ultimately what he does, it brings the church as a result, as an expression of that. And that's what I believe is making the connection into the Great Commission. It speaks of now how the church is supposed to go and make disciples. One of the beautiful things about Jesus, and if you can just, again, just process this with me tonight, when the person affirms, when the person, when the individual, when the family, when the church proclaims the supremacy of Jesus, when we understand that the antidote of this season of life, the certainty of this season of life is exclusively, the only thing that is for certain and unmovable is the person of Christ, the qualities, the character of Jesus, what that produces. I need to hear this very, very closely. What that produces, if you have the ability to articulate, to confess that Jesus is who he said he is, if you have that ability, the guarantee, the promise is not necessarily a better school year. The promise and the guarantee is not that the church is going to thrive as a pastor. The guarantee is not that the cancer or COVID is going to be dissipated. The guarantee is that you will be able to have an experience of doxology, of worship. That's the result. It is the ability to be free from self-indulgence or self-focus, meaning worshiping myself, worshiping my thinking, worshiping my past, worshiping my dreams, worshiping my fears, worshiping my identity or who I think I am. So again, if you can just dream with me again, with a generation of students moving into a brand new school year, that the focus is the worship of the person of Jesus, that we understand the beauty, the magnitude, the bigness of Jesus. So when we think of the character of Jesus, the actual doctrinal statements that Jesus made about himself, think about it, because it is he who fulfills the scriptures. He is the reason why this becomes obtainable, tangible. And even I will say, and I'm going to explain that in just a second, but the scriptures become transferable, imputed. I'm talking about his obedience, his submission to the scriptures. You know, it's given to us, it's imputed to us because of his supremacy. So we ended up simply worshiping. We ended up being free, not from the circumstances, but free to stop depending on circumstances, which that creates a sense of community. And this is extremely important because this is one of the principles that Dr. Bob in his commentaries and his teaching emphasizes tremendously, which is the health of the church. In other words, when you experience, when you have a generation, when you have a marriage, when you have a family, when you have a church, that the centrality of the gospel is a driving force. When you are free, not from circumstances, but you are free from depending or codependence on circumstances, then you understand that this experience of worship, acknowledging who Jesus is for the benefit of others. And this is why we call this the worldview of Christ, is the selflessness of Jesus. I'm thinking of Philippians chapter 2. The mind, Paul says that there may be in every one of you, every one of us, the mind of Jesus. And then he describes this humility, this mindset that he came and detached. He came and utilized all of his cosmic authority, literally to benefit others. So in this case, my argument or my kind of a conclusion over this issue is that when selflessness is the driving force versus community, selfishness, when selfishness is our driving force versus selflessness, when we are driven by egocentric mindset in the name of whatever it is that we're doing, my kind of a take on this and understanding is that is the result of the absence of the supremacy of Jesus, which implies if Jesus is not supreme, then I'm the one that potentially I'm thinking that I am the one who's running the show, or again thinking that this book is about me, it's about my well-being, it's about the things that work for me. And that's exactly when we run into trouble. Ultimately, now you get a movement, you get a generation of young men and young women, you get a generation of marriages, you get a generation of elderly, that the driving force is literally service. This is where I will say that theology becomes relational. I don't know if that principle helps anybody, but this is obviously theology, right? I mean, this is just the truth about Jesus that he said about himself, and this is literally the worldview of Jesus being exercised. So if you want to put it in this way, this is Friday for me, and then this is the 33 years, the life of Jesus. This is what happened before Friday. From the moment that he's born from a virgin, Christmas time, into the moment that he goes into a Roman cross on that Friday, I will say that's the worldview of Jesus. Those are the 33 years that he spent on earth, literally fulfilling, submitting himself to the scriptures, and then eventually gets to the place where now he's going to fulfill everything that he said, everything that he taught, everything that he embraced, everything that he experienced. So the combination of both literally creates a generation of, again, the body of Christ, where they think and they build everything on theology. Remember, justification, that produces eventually that exercising of a life of service. In that context, on verse 13, after this whole, you know, you need to guard yourselves from the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees, then When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, it is Jesus who asked his disciples, and this is the question, who do people say the Son of Man is? So now he's becoming into that kind of an inner circle, once again, in the sense of the questioning, the relationships, the teaching, the experience. And now he's moving into a reminder, because again, you got to remember that Jesus is moving towards Jerusalem. He's going exactly to fulfill the promises, that the reason why he came. So as a person, he's coming to fulfill, you know, that mandate. He is that fulfillment of Genesis chapter 3, verse 15, as he's about to be, you know, bruised by the seed of the serpent, in this case. And we're speaking of that suffering on Friday. And as he's moving into that, he wants to make sure that, once again, the antidote of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees is not a better version, a better context, a better environment. The antidote of false teaching, the antidote of the secularism, the antidote of everything that is happening, and our children are and will be exposed in academic levels, is the understanding of the affirmations that Jesus makes or made about himself. This is what I meant earlier. If we can become a generation that we are able to articulate what Jesus said about himself. We are so enamored, we're so driven by trying to learn and to articulate who we are. This is why I keep on saying that the gospel is not our testimony, my testimony, what happened to me and how I came to know Christ. My argument is that as important as it is what happened to you and how I came to know Christ, that's the result of the gospel. The gospel is not my experience. I am not the gospel. The gospel is Jesus Christ. And this is the moment where Jesus, after he warns them of the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees, he basically presents the solution. And this is so important. And let me just take a few minutes to explain this. This is the beauty of the scriptures. And this is what I'm hoping that we can get a little bit of these principles tonight. The beauty of the scriptures is that Jesus not only makes these affirmations, but Jesus also explains those affirmations. In other words, it's not enough simply to believe what Jesus said, but it's also very, very crucial and important that is the result of believing what Jesus says, understanding, applying the implications of those teachings. I will even argue that my understanding of the epistles, meaning the letters written after the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, Acts. What you see the remainder of the New Testament is basically those apostles writing these letters to the churches because they needed to close the gap between the words of Jesus and the meaning of the words of Jesus. In other words, the church were embracing what Jesus said as long as they felt, free to or entitled to interpret or to apply however they felt or thought the words that Jesus said. And I think that's exactly where we are today. I think, for our students moving into this brand new season, for the church as we try to navigate, again, the remaining of the year, COVID and all these transitions, in our government system. Tragically, many of us do embrace what Jesus says, but we still feel very entitled to really interpret, apply, or ignore the meaning of the words of Jesus. And this is why Jesus comes and says, who do people say that the Son of Man is? This terminology, this reference of him, himself, calling himself the Son of Man, has a massive implication, which again, I'm hoping that this is where this school year, as parents, as grandparents, we take on the responsibility to communicate, to disciple, to simply grow into the understanding of everything that Jesus said about himself. Because the terminology of the Son of Man implies two things. It implies that he is fully divine and that he is fully human. I'm going to say that again. It implies that Jesus is literally the second person of the Trinity. But at the same time, in the same breath, in the same understanding, that he is also Messiah. That he is also the one that has or had the ability, based on his given of his life as the perfect sacrifice, literally that he has the ability to forgive all sins. Again, remember that this is the time that he is rebuking the teaching of the Pharisees and Sadducees, Because the Pharisees and Sadducees, they did not oppose that someone like Jesus as a rabbi will teach about God. The challenge was for the Pharisees and Sadducees that they were not expecting, nor they approved that Jesus will call himself God, the one who was teaching. So again, they didn't oppose a rabbi teaching about God, but they would oppose that he himself was God who was teaching. And this is why when it comes to that experience of the weekend, that sacrificial, that giving of his life in our place, Paul says in Corinthians that the one who knew no sin, for our sake, he became sin. That's exactly what Jesus presents and gives. So that's the concept of forgiveness. Now, this is not universalism, so I don't believe that that the forgiving of sins is just automatically. You got to confess, obviously, right? So there is literally, there is no unconditional love, because this has a condition. For you to be forgiven, you have to acknowledge. And again, we live in a time and age where the only sin is literally to say that there is no sin. We're in a time and age where everything goes, and again, there is no absolute, and you and I know the confusion that we're in. So for us to speak of forgiveness, because this is part of the implication that in his humanity, right, in his humanity, that Jesus has the ability, had the ability to simply get into the place that his blood, the shedding of his blood, literally he is the fulfillment of that sacrifice, and that when he gives his blood, he is able to forgive the sins of the world. Now, that forgiveness as necessary, the death of Jesus as prophesied, as announced, and as God established before the foundations of the world, that it was necessary, as important as it is, this is not enough. The death of Jesus is not enough. You also need the life of Jesus, because this only brings innocence into our lives. This only places us into a stage where we are innocent, we are forgiven. But you got to remember that this is about God. And one of the distinctiveness, one of the attributes of God is his holiness. And when it comes to us, when it comes to our position before God, forgiveness is not enough. We must be clothed, imputed, accredited the righteousness of someone else into our account. Obviously, I'm speaking the language of the Reformation 500 years ago. That's exactly what took place, right? So in this case, please listen to me. This is the death of Jesus, the Son of Man, the one who died, but also this is the life of Jesus. So his entire obedience is transferred, is given. And when I say obedience, I'm speaking obedience to the scriptures, to the law. It's where Jesus literally transferred his obedience unto us. So the combination of both is what actually creates and enables men and women to be children of God. Now, in that context, Jesus continues and says, they reply, some say, here's kind of the answers that they gave, John the Baptist, Elijah, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. See, this school year, this season of our lives, just as it was for this people 2,000 years ago, based on what Jesus said about himself. Now, he's asking the question, what do people say about him? But when the open question of what people say about him is based on an object. So the focus is not on what people said, the focus is on what Jesus said about himself. Because I just explained that, what that entails by calling himself the Son of Man. Now, once you get the responses based on the object, so important as the responses are, based on the object, here is ultimately what is going to kind of come out of this year, come out of this season of our lives, come out of whatever we're facing at a personal level, emotional level, intellectual level, family level, financial level. Either God is who he said he is, or he is an imposter. He is a pretender. That's exactly where we are. Either we're going to be able to, as we go back to school, as we send the kids back to school, as we make decisions, as we make transitions, as we process whatever we're processing and enjoying the beauty of the blessings of God, or maybe the sorrow and the grief that we might be facing, we are at the place that we have to be able to articulate what salvation looks like. I'm not speaking if we feel saved or that we don't feel saved anymore. I'm not against feelings. I'm not against experiences. I'm not against how you were raised and how you were taught and what happened prior to X, Y, and Z. I'm not against those things. But the prayer, the desire, the hope is based literally on that crossroads. And I think COVID has brought us into that crossroads. What we see going on today is bringing us into that crossroads, that either God is who he said he is, or he's a pretender. Now, one quick parenthesis before I close our time tonight. My understanding of the Bible, and again, you don't have to agree with me, but I will invite you to check the scriptures. For someone to make the confession that God is who he said he is, that person is to be enabled, empowered by the Holy Spirit. This is more than intellectual assent. This is more than just simply taking a course or experiencing a sermon. This is literally the supernatural intervention of the God of the Bible. For someone to make the confession, for someone to process a brand new school year through the lenses of the supremacy of Jesus, that he is the Son of Man, that he's able to forgive, and that he's able to impute, to give. He's able and willing to receive, to accredit to himself the sins of the world. But at the same time, he is able and he's willing on that Sunday morning when he comes out of the graveside, he's able to transfer, to accredit his righteousness, his justice, his obedience to us. That is exactly Jesus. So for you and I to confess that and see God as God versus a pretender, this is the work of the Holy Spirit. So if you have never, ever experienced the empowerment, the ability to say yes to the gospel, if you have never asked for forgiveness of your sins, and you have never felt or received, again, the imputation, the transferring of the righteousness of Jesus, if Jesus hasn't made you his own, I'm inviting you to consider that. Because, see, this is what happens. This is what happens. But what about you? And the you obviously is plural. He's asking them, you know, that kind of an intimate group of people that walk with Jesus, who do you say I am? I believe that's exactly the question that our students, our churches, our government, our generation is faced in moments like this. Who do you say I am? Many of you know the passage, and many of you know how this dialogue is going to end, by Simon Peter giving the answer that was not given, now listen to this, was not revealed by blood, by flesh, but was revealed by the Spirit of God. Jesus says, by my heavenly Father. What is that he revealed? Well, he revealed and he gave Peter the ability to confess that he, meaning Jesus, you are Messiah, which means you are the Son of the living God. This revelation that Peter received does not diminish the ability of the confession. So this is the both end of the conversation. God intervenes, but obviously there's got to be a human response to that. So I take nothing away from Peter having that desire, that willingness, the volition, we call the will, the you know, the free will to say yes to this confession. But I'm going to say that again, you know, tonight, many of us, we got to make this confession in the context of uncertainty, in the context of life potentially not making sense, maybe in the context of comfort and maybe feeling very secure. I don't know where we might be today in this regard, but ultimately, the bottom line of our conversation tonight is having the ability to confess that literally he is Messiah, which implies that Messiah implies the work of Jesus, that we can experience, that sacrificial experience, the ability that Jesus had, the ability that Jesus, again, before the foundations of the world, that he will become the suffering servant, that he will be known as the man of sorrows, that he will take our place, which implies that the punishment, that the wrath of God placed on Jesus was literally the right thing to do, because he positioned himself as the guilty one, as the one who literally became the accumulation of our transgressions, of our rebellion. He became the most obscene expression of sin on that Friday. So the work of Jesus is just, you know, it is something that is correlated to the understanding of his messiahship, of his reason why he came. But at the same time, this is the same Jesus, that it is the Son of the living God. He is the person. He is the one that came and literally lived a perfect life. He is the one that came and submitted as the second person of the Trinity to the first person of the Trinity. And in this context of submission, in this context of oneness, literally he was able to fulfill every single thing. So his perfect obedience guaranteed his resurrection on Sunday. So once again, on Friday, we transfer our sin to Jesus. And on Sunday, he transferred, he imputed, he accredited his righteousness to us. So he gives us four beautiful things to take into the brand new school year. And some of you may want to write this down for the school year. Number one, legally, we are forgiven because of this double transaction, double accreditation, double imputation. Sin given to Jesus, perfection, obedience, righteousness given to us. Legally, we are innocent. Legally, God sees us because of the life of Jesus, perfection. He sees us, he sees you, he sees me in this brand new season as someone that has never sinned. So innocence, never sinned before. And then thirdly, because of the double transaction, now we have, through Jesus, God sees us as if we have obeyed the entire Bible. I'm speaking from the legal component. I'm not saying that we have done it, but Jesus did it. He imputed that to us. And number four is that forever, 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 we rest on the assurance that we belong as children of the living God. 2,000 years later, this man and women that will listen to this teaching, that will be confronted with this, literally, eventually, through the empowerment of the Holy Spirit, not only confessed, but they were able to process the remaining of their days through the word, through the person of Jesus Christ. Have a wonderful rest of this week. We will see you next Tuesday, and you and your kids may have a wonderful school and blessed school year for this year. God bless.